Steven Spielberg focused his movie Lincoln on the 16th president's tumultuous final months in office when he pursued a course of action to end the Civil War, reunite the country, and abolish slavery. Invited by the filmmakers to write a special Lincoln book as a companion to the film, Harold Holzer, the distinguished historian and a consultant on the movie, has written a new book on Lincoln's life and times, his evolving beliefs about slavery, and how he maneuvered to end it. The book, Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America, is a companion to the film geared to young readers. Harold Holzer is one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln and the political culture of the Civil War era. He serves as chairman of the Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation and was a content consultant to the Steven Spielberg film, Lincoln. He has authored, co-authored, and edited 42 books, including Emancipating Lincoln and Lincoln at Cooper Union. He joins us this morning at the New York State Museum. The film opens on Friday, and it's a great pleasure to have Harold Holzer with us. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be back in Albany.
What is the, for you, the lure of telling the story again and helping on a film that obviously is going to reach an entirely new audience?
Well, I suspected from the first request to get involved 4 or 5 years ago on a very casual basis that it was going to reach a broad audience. I never imagined the kind of publicity juggernaut that would bring us to this place where it's on everybody's lips and everyone is asking about it. It's on posters and television commercials throughout the election. The great unifier. If you turned on CNN or Fox or ABC or PBS, well, no, PBS doesn't have commercials, but it's an amazing marketing juggernaut right now, and everyone is asking about it. It couldn't come at a better time because it is the 150th anniversary of a neglected or misunderstood document, the Emancipation Proclamation, which is a perfect time to come to grips again with Lincoln's legacy.
You, as a consultant on the film, I assume when someone says, obviously you're dealing with great people here, but early if you hear that someone is going to do something on Lincoln, that you have to wince a little bit. What do you want to make sure happens and what is told in that story?
I think, well, what my role was, and it was quite specific, it was to make sure, if I could, that the things that were told were not gratuitously off the radar screen in terms of reality. Clearly, this is a flight of fancy and imagination. I read the script in its first draft, and that was my role, take a look at it and tell us what, you know, totally loopy things are here so that we don't get left out of the city or out of every city. And you know, I've described it as Shakespearean. It's like a Shakespeare history. There's no effort until the very end of the movie to have Lincoln speak his great words that we're familiar with. So you don't get a sense that an actor is casually walking around the White House or a set pronouncing these aphorisms and sound bites that we know so well in a different setting. They don't try for that. It's totally new and different and a reimagining of history. But the amazing thing is that they've gotten it so right.
Tony Kushner earlier in the show said he was writing the first screenplay, turned out to be 500 pages, and he was shocked. But in looking at that, and obviously it's been whittled down, but getting that voice right. I mean, I said this to him, you know, what is it like to put words in the mouth of the person who wrote the second inaugural?
I don't think he's shy about it. I mean, he's put the words in Roy Cohn's mouth and other people's mouth. He's quite ingenious. It all comes out in a way sounding like Tony Kushner, but that's not bad because he inhabits the eras and the situations that he's writing about. He and Spielberg both read very widely on this issue. They studied, they visited original sites, they went out to Springfield, as did Daniel Day-Lewis. They went to Washington. They tried not only to inhale atmosphere, which method actors are famous for doing, for better or for worse, but they studied. And clearly from the voice, the physical voice you hear, the audio of Daniel Day-Lewis, you are hearing a very calculated effort to come close to a regional accent and a timbre of voice that purportedly Lincoln really had, which is surprising a lot of people. There's a lot of talk about the voice. How can this be Lincoln? He doesn't sound like Gregory Peck or Raymond Massey or Hal Holbrook or Sam Waterston. He sounds different. And he's channeled something here, has Day-Lewis, through his own experience and his own talent that comes, it seems to me, to come pretty close to what Lincoln really sounded like.
When you look at the story that's being told, and as Kushner explains, and even in your book in The Companion, it has to be, because it is a movie, it is obviously pared down to this very specific issue in this very specific time period. So for you in telling that story, what are the important ingredients?
The Companion book was designed to expand a bit on those final 4 months and to go a little bit, to drill down a little bit on what the chronology means in the movie. Spielberg took that 500-page draft, I guess, and decided the real story here is an unfamiliar one to most Americans, certainly to kids, who I think would profit from seeing this movie. And that is the 13th Amendment. How is it passed? What does it show about a president wielding power and influence, moving Congress to his will, bending Congress to his will, getting public opinion behind him? How does a leader do that? And he chose this final effort of Lincoln's career, the effort to get a constitutional amendment passed, which was even harder then than it is now. It had been 50 or 60 years since the last constitutional amendment. There had only been two after the Bill of Rights, and it was not easy to do. And he decided he had to do it because if peace came too quickly, and this is the great irony of Lincoln making this great war, 750,000 people dying. But he thought that if the war ended as quickly as he hoped, the Union would be restored with slavery intact in those areas not yet touched by the Emancipation Proclamation. So this is the consummation of his lifelong antipathy towards slavery. And what I did in the book at the request of HarperCollins is trace the story of Lincoln's changing attitudes towards slavery and his changing view of what he as an executive could do to kill it. And that's what I did in the book.
You do also put it into a context. Let us know about his boyhood. Let us know about growing up, the time in the Senate, because all of this plays a part, very much into a part, into those 4 months.
Right, because Abraham Lincoln was enlightened for his age, but does not seem enlightened for our age. I always tell people that, you know, was Lincoln a racist, I'm asked. And I say, well, compared to George W. Bush, yes. And people are surprised. Well, how could you say that? You know, George W. Bush was a conservative president. I said, but George W. Bush was a late 20th century man. Lincoln was a mid-19th century man who had grown up in the backwoods of Kentucky and Indiana, did not know any people of color, knew of slavery, and was repelled by it. But while he thought it was an ugly situation that deprived people of dignity and the chance at opportunity, he didn't empathize with the slaves themselves. He just saw it as a system that had to be destroyed. How that came to change in his own mind is a great story, and it has to do with meeting people over the years whom he never had the opportunity to meet in his earlier years. He couldn't have known a Frederick Douglass in the backwoods of Kentucky, although it's hard to imagine that there was a Lincoln in the backwoods of Kentucky either. But when he met Frederick Douglass, when he met Sojourner Truth, when African Americans fought for their own freedom in the Union Army, that's when Lincoln changed from a person who believed in free labor to a person who believed more and more in equal rights.
In looking at that, at the picture that we have of this man, when you consider the time period, again, this 4 months, inspired by Doris Kearns Goodwin's team of rivals, how much is that story of the rivalry and the relationship with those men that lead to this time and to this place?
When this film opens, there is no rivalry. You see a cabinet that is fractious. But in fact, in 1864 and 1865, a few of Lincoln's rivals, or his early rivals, so-called, had already left the cabinet. Salmon P. Chase was gone. There was a new attorney general. There was a new secretary of the treasury, and there was another secretary of war. Simon Cameron had been a rival, but he had been ousted from the cabinet in 1862. So it was a different situation. And you see Secretary of State William Seward functioning almost as a chief of staff would today, a White House chief of staff. He's Lincoln's emissary. He's going out there rounding up votes, convincing people to vote for the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, even using a little bit of political grease things that would be illegal today and probably were illegal then. And I think it makes a good point. Lincoln pushed the envelope when it came to getting this amendment passed. He did offer jobs to people who had already been defeated for re-election to the Congress. It's not in the movie, but it's in my book. He did offer to stop a regulatory effort for railroads in New Jersey in order to win some New Jersey votes who were pro-railroad. He was not a holier-than-thou executive. He knew how to get votes. He needed a lot of Democratic opposition votes to get this amendment passed, and he went after them. So I think you don't see the rivalry here. I think Doris Goodwin would be the first to admit that, because this is really 25 pages of her 700-page book, and it's Lincoln at the apex of his powers. He's been reelected. He has no rivals anyplace, and he knows it, so he's going to use all the power he's got.
And he's learned a lot of really good politics. I don't want to say political tricks, but he's learned a lot about the game.
He's always known the game, but you know, it helps when you've really got a lot of power to play out the tricks. Lincoln is a political animal. You know, he is raised in the roiling world of politics in Illinois in the 1850s, anti-slavery politics, the formation of the Republican Party. He's been beaten from time to time, and he knows what it feels like. I mean, he went into the 1855 legislative session in Springfield, Illinois, the overwhelming favorite to be elected to the United States Senate. In those days, the choice was made by the legislature, not by the direct vote of the people. And he went in there. I mean, he was just like Kirsten Gillibrand. He was the overwhelming favorite. How would she like it if she walked in on election day and they said, well, we're not giving it to you, even though you got 73% of the popular vote. We're not giving it to that lady who ran against you. We found somebody else. We're going to just go somewhere else. And that's what they did to Lincoln. And it was a friend of his, Lyman Trumbull, who, by the way, was annoyed with him in the period covered in the movie and the book. And this other guy walked away with the prize. So Lincoln knew, sometimes he won, sometimes he lost, but he knew that it was a bare-knuckle contact sport, and he was willing to move the chess pieces as surreptitiously or be a battering ram as openly as was necessary to win what he wanted to win. The good thing about, well, I think the noble thing about this particular cause is that it was an exalted mission, that is, to end slavery in America before he lost the power to do that.
Harold Holzer is the author of the book Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. It's a companion book for young readers to the Steven Spielberg film. He is also a contributor to another anthology. It is Lincoln, the President for the Ages. And this is a collection of essays. You have written the final essay in the book, which is entitled Lincoln, the Unlikely Celebrity. How is he an unlikely celebrity?
Well, I think he was an unlikely celebrity then and would be now as well, because he was sort of unlike what most people looked like in those days and had different manners than the most refined politicians. He was taller, ganglier, uglier, had that voice that was sometimes an asset, sometimes not. In an age when images were starting to become very important, he had a disadvantage. He learned how to conquer that by getting image makers to portray him in a way that was romanticized and flattering. And it was his genius that he conquered that milieu as well by getting sympathetic portrayals made of him. It just leads you to the conclusion, as they asked me to speculate for this anthology, could Lincoln have made it today? And the answer is sure. He would have, you know, probably not had a beard, and he would have worn a baseball cap like Steven Spielberg instead of a top hat like Abraham Lincoln, and he would have been fine, because he's smart enough to adapt.
Early on in the essay, you talk about that question, could Abraham Lincoln have succeeded in the modern political arena? But I was struck by the fact that the question you get often asked often the most, was Lincoln gay? Did Lincoln suffer from depression? Did he have a fatal disease? It's interesting that that's where we so often think.
We want the definitive answers to all of these mysteries, real and imagined. Lincoln has been diagnosed from a distance with so many diseases, it's hard to imagine that he was able to get up in the morning and do anything. But he did. I mean, he had enormous energy. And the other cheat answer I give when people say, what was Lincoln's greatest attribute? I always say good health, because he was sick for only about 3 weeks in his 4.5 years as president. And it was 1 3-week stretch that he had a smallpox battle on his hands, for a mild case of smallpox. But he had 17, 18-hour days without rest for 4 years and survived. Lost too much weight, became achy, might have been getting some cardiovascular problems, which wouldn't have been unusual, but amazing strength and physical strength, real physical strength, the kind that, you know, people show off in crowds. You know, Lincoln would like taking an axe between his forefinger and his thumb and holding it out at arm's length for a few seconds and then letting it fall to the ground and then daring the younger men in the group to see if they could do that. And nobody ever could. That's how strong he was.
It's a bar trick.
Yeah, a bar trick, right. He didn't go to bars, but it was a bar trick. But I'll tell you, he did it on the last boat ride home from his last visit to the front in April 1865, when he was supposedly an emaciated, crumbling old man. He did that at the axe trick, and the young men on board, including a French visitor, were all unable to replicate it. He always loved the fact that nobody else could do it.
You talked a moment ago about the questions and the mysteries that surround him. For you, as an historian, as someone who has dedicated so much of your life looking and exploring this man, what are the mysteries for you?
The mysteries remain his views on race. What were they in 1861? What were they when he died? I mean, I've speculated about it in the young adult book, but I would still love to have the conversation. I'd love to know the mystery of his, or unravel the mystery of his relationship to his father, because I think it motivated or influenced so many of his later decisions and his own independence and his own child-rearing decisions. I'd like to know how many drafts he wrote of the Gettysburg Address and how quickly he wrote it, get him to debunk once and for all the idea that he wrote it on the back of an envelope. I'd like to know what he really meant when he said, "I haven't controlled events through this war, the events have controlled me." I would have said, "Isn't that just a great line? You don't really mean that, do you?" Things like that, around the edges, because I think it's dangerous for us to speculate too much. I mean, we have his writing. He wrote a million words, and he wrote as beautifully as any great American writer, as most great writers have acknowledged. He could have been a great writer of any kind. And so we have that archive, but you know, I think in the end, if we had him here and you were interviewing him, and you're a better interviewer than I, and you had him before you, he probably would hold enough in reserve so that we'd leave this interview with the mystery still there. He didn't tell his closest friends what he didn't want to tell them. And that's one of the reasons he's a mystery, because he didn't unravel his story to them either.
And here again, this is back to being a good politician, being that political animal that you mentioned earlier.
Lincoln had this uncanny ability to make everyone think that he was his best friend. And then, in later years, they were asked, "What did Lincoln do for you? Because you were, after all, his best friend. You've just told us that he was you were his best friend." They said, "Well, you know, he never did anything for me. He never listened to me. He never gave me a reward, a political reward. I asked him for favors. He never followed through. In fact, he dropped me. Now that I think about it, I may have been his best friend, but what did I ever get out of it? Just the right to say, the privilege of saying he was my best friend." Because Lincoln was an interesting kind of ally. He had a way of leaving one world behind as he moved to the next. You know, he had good friends in New Salem, Illinois, when he moved there at age 22. And when he moved on to Springfield, Illinois, he sort of left those New Salem rural rustic types behind. And for all that his Springfield, Illinois, and other Illinois friends did to get him the nomination for president, when he went to Washington, as you've pointed out, whether or not it's really a team of rivals or just a team of the best politicians in the country, he went to the best politicians in the country. He didn't know all of them, but it's a classic reminder that presidents do best when they choose their peers and not their cronies. He left his cronies behind. So he may have remained a mystery to them, but he was doing a service to the country, I think.
The film opens wide and officially on Friday, and you've seen the final film. What do you think?
I thought it was just totally enrapturing. The first thing I said to my wife when I finished it is, I want to see it again. Unfortunately, it was not one of those things like from the 1960s where you can stay at a movie all day and see it four times. I'm actually, Mr. Spielberg has been nice enough to have a screening arranged for a group of that I co-chair called the Lincoln Forum, which is going to be meeting in Gettysburg a few days before Spielberg, himself comes to Gettysburg to deliver the Gettysburg Address on the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, November 19th. So he's taken over everything, even that. He's going to give the Gettysburg Address this year.
And as far as seeing it and obviously knowing your contribution to it and seeing the acting, seeing the writing, seeing everything come together, it must be a pleasurable experience.
I think it's pleasurable. It's instructive. I felt a little nervous watching it because I was hoping, you know, really hoping it was going to come out well and that it could be recommended to historians, to parents, to kids. And I think, you know, it's a teachable moment, or in this case, a teachable 2 hours and 30 minutes. It's worth, I think the New York Times had it right. It's worth making everybody see it, making the family see it. It may not have animation, it may not have special effects, but it has reality and it has the way of looking, giving you an understanding of what it took to get things done. And maybe it'll make us a little more tolerant of how difficult it is to get things done today.
Harold Holzer was a content consultant to the Steven Spielberg film Lincoln, which opens on Friday. His new book is Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. The book is published by Newmarket and geared to young readers. Harold, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much. A great pleasure.
Thank you for having me again. Thanks.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.